leads me to start off by reporting that when the United States Navy did itself the honor of selecting for the first time in naval history a woman to be an admiral, the head of our nurse corps, Miss Eileen Durick, my pictures appeared in the newspapers around the land as she was being awarded her two stars. I was pictured kissing her. I received a letter soon thereafter from an old friend saying, "Dear Bud, I never thought I'd live to see the day when the Chief of Naval Operations was kissing an admiral." I sat right down and wrote back, "Old friend, you need to be aware that nobody ever became the Chief of Naval Operations without having kissed a lot of admirals."
Admiral Zumwalt's ready for your questions. First question, please.
Sir, Lieutenant Colonel A.G., United States Army, what do you consider the most serious single Soviet threat facing us today? Is it in the nuclear supremacy area or in the more conventional areas of naval supremacy or possibly land force supremacy?
The problem I have in answering that question, which is a good question, is that one has to look at it in two frames of reference, I think. First is, where are we in serious trouble from the standpoint of just sheer military capability? And second, where are we likeliest to have difficulty? And those are two different answers. With regard to the first, until we regain strategic nuclear parity, in my judgment, no conventional advantage can possibly have much relevance to us. I'm in favor of doing both simultaneously, obviously. But with the Soviets having a strategic nuclear advantage of the kind they now have, a capability to kill well over 10 times as many Americans as we can kill Soviets, the President of the United States is going to be told by his military advisors, as he was in the Yom Kippur War, if you push beyond a boast, you'll lose. And therefore, a president is going to have to accommodate until he regains that. The second greatest area of weakness in that context is Europe. The Soviet Union has a capability to overrun Europe in weeks. The only real argument is it 3 or is it 10? We've known that for years. We pretend for public purposes that that's not the case, but no military man worth his salt believes that we can hold Europe today. The third most significant problem, in my judgment, is that the United States, the odds are, would lose a naval war at sea with the Soviet Union. And we've got to regain a capability to reinforce Europe and to reinforce Japan. We have known for 7 or 8 years that in a war with the Soviet Union today, we would abandon Japan, Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, and concentrate on the defense of Hawaii and Alaska in the Pacific and on a desperate effort to reinforce Europe in the Atlantic. And now, with regard to the second frame of reference, where are we likeliest to have trouble? It's going to be wherever the Soviets feel they can get away with it cheaply. They are going to use their strategic nuclear advantage and their conventional military advantage not to carry out those kinds of wars that I've just described, unless we miscalculate and take them on, but rather to force us to accommodate to the invasion of Angola, the two invasions of Zaire, the coup in Afghanistan, the two coups in the Yemens, and so on. That's the nature of Soviet strategy, and that's where we're going to begin to hurt more and more and more.
Next question, please.
Sir, I'm Major Alexander, United States Air Force. Looking at the third item that you enumerated, our weakness at sea, the House recently passed an appropriation bill that included approximately $2.1 billion that is earmarked for the construction of another nuclear-powered carrier. Do you believe that that's an efficient utilization of our limited budget resources?
The short answer is no. And the long answer is that in a democracy such as ours, it was the least worst alternative. That is, the Navy is in such desperate straits that it must have more capability. We should have built, for that $2.2 billion, a fossil-fueled aircraft carrier and 5 escort vessels, as an example. or we should have built the fossil fuel carrier and spent the $1 billion for another kind of naval capability. There's a $1 billion difference in the nuclear plant. I strongly supported the president's inclination toward the fossil fuel carrier. On the other hand, given the Rickover lobby on Capitol Hill, it was clear that you were going to have nothing or a nuclear-propelled carrier. As between those two alternatives, I prefer the gold-plated version rather than nothing.
Next question, please.
Lieutenant Commander Anderson, sir. If we, in fact, have the military machinery to catch up with the Soviets in strategic posture, how long would it take if we could start today?
In my judgment, to regain equality in the strategic nuclear field would take a minimum of 5 years, and it would take a all-out brickbat priority effort with regard to the strategic cruise missile and with regard to the aircraft from which it's going to be launched. My own personal desire would be to see the B-1 restored, but some kind of a crash effort to get an aircraft that can carry the cruise missile along with the ships and the submarines that would carry it. The single greatest reason for the disparity in capability today is the Soviet ability to knock out a very large number of our ICBMs in the first strike. Until they had demonstrated their latest accuracy, the Soviet Union had the capability to destroy about 70% of our ICBMs in a first strike with about 40% of their MIRV ICBMs. With their new accuracies of 0.1 tenth of a mile, the Soviet Union has the capability to destroy about 95% of our ICBMs with 20% of their MIRV ICBMs. And that, in essence, is the capability to castrate us with regard to any accuracy. We have never been permitted to build accuracy into the submarine ballistic missile. The theory of the McGovernites has always prevailed that we should not have a capability to hit targets accurately with our submarine missiles, but rather should use them as the city busters. That made sense at one time, but now that the cities will be empty, it doesn't make too much sense.
Next question, please.
Sir, Major Anderson, United States Army. How do you reconcile the apparent will of the American people to take a harder stance and the political realities that we're seeing in not coming up with enough dollars for the defense budget?
I think that we are seeing a dramatic change that has only really begun to surface in the terms that you have set, namely congressional appropriations. During the 4 years that I was a member of the JCS, the normal thing was a $5 to $7 billion cut in the president's defense programs by the Congress. This year, there have actually been programs added to the presidential budget. That is a dramatic turnaround on the part of the Congress. The very same people that are voting for the Proposition 13 type of phenomena around the country, saying we've been very wasteful in our domestic expenditures, are quite inclined to support more defense capability. And I believe that political leaders are beginning to sense that more and more. I think that President Carter is hoist somewhat on the petard of a number of campaign promises, but he's a political realist, and I believe in time that he will come to support better defense budgets than the one he has put forward this year, which in my judgment can best be described as disastrous for the country.
Next question, please.
Sir, Major Osach, United States Air Force. I'd like to turn the corner on that question. You talked about the national resolve of an enlightened American people. How do you see the resolve of the Soviet bloc people in terms of the apparent problems they have had to face in coping with Soviet expansion on a military level in terms of their own personal liberties and economic lifestyle?
Well, I think that the Soviet people can best be described as passively accepting what it is that has gone on. Their dissidents are few in number, and they are the very most intellectual elite, and those intellectual elite have been made to appear as renegades or traitors to a very large percentage of the population. My wife, who was born of Russian refugee parents, has first cousins in the Soviet Union, from whom we heard indirectly a year or so ago. One who is about her age was describing happily how wonderful it was what Mother Russia had done for them. They have just, in their 50s, achieved their first apartment for their very own. Up until that time, for the 30 years of their married life, they had been living with other families. They saw that as great progress, and it has been made to appear to be great progress. If you don't expect very much, what you get can be very little and look good. Now, the other thing that has hurt us with regard to what I think is implicit in your question, namely, is there opportunity to turn this thing around from within, is that we are violating the advice that Solzhenitsyn has given us. If you read his magnificent speeches, at the end of his dramatic summaries of the historical lessons as he sees them, there is a strong admonition to the West, loosely paraphrased, which says, don't give in, hang tough, negotiate toughly, give us time to change the system from within. We haven't given the Russian people any hope that there is something strong against which they're going to have to accommodate, but rather have given their leaders an opportunity to show success after success around the globe, which converts to chauvinistic and patriotic pluses for the average Russian.
Next question, please.
Lieutenant Commander Pearson, U.S. Navy. Admiral, how do you propose to pay for the increase in hardware that would be required to achieve nuclear and conventional parity with the Soviets?
I believe that the answer is that we cannot afford not to spend the money. And I mean that financially, not from the standpoint of our national security. Let me come at it this way. I believe that if we had spent $5 to $8 billion or more, a year more, $5 to $8 billion a year more for defense budgets, from the middle 60s through the middle 70s, that the Soviet Union would not have been able to bring off its dramatic economic victory in the Middle East crisis of 1973, out of which the OPEC prices were quadrupled and subsequently in total quintupled. And if one examines the billions of dollars that we have had to throw into the Middle East as a result of that Soviet strategic economic victory, defense budgets would be a very cheap insurance policy to have prevented it. One hears the counter argument, well, that would have come anyway. I asked the Shah of Iran that when I visited him last July. And his answer was, sure, oil prices would have gone up gradually over the years, but the West's inferiority gave us the opportunity to bring about a sudden, huge increase. And if one integrates over the years that it would have taken, the loss that we took by that huge step increase, what we spent for defense would have been a mere fraction of what the West has had to spend. The second question that generally comes out of that kind of a statement is, well, aren't you giving the Soviet Union too much credit for having achieved that? Wasn't that really more of an Arab and an OPEC kind of a thing? And the answer to that has been very well documented by Ambassador Foy Kohler in his work down at the University of Miami. The Soviet Union at the time of the crisis, it is documented, was advising and urging and exhorting every Arab nation to embargo us and was urging the oil prices to be increased. Kohler's work, as I recall it, points out first that the Soviet Union had already agreed to this attack before they signed the summit agreement with us, that in which both sides promised not to gain marginal advantage and to avoid a nuclear confrontation. Second, that they removed their advisors from Syria just before the strike without warning us. Third, that they went on a strategic nuclear alert 3 weeks before we went on ours without warning us. Four, that they alerted five of their seven airborne divisions and redeployed some of them to be ready to go in and help their Arab client without warning us. Fifth or sixth that they exhorted the Arabs to do the embargo, that they exhorted OPEC to quadruple the oil prices, that they promised the Arabs that they would protect them from any marketing and production difficulties, that they promised them that they had the military superiority over the West to prevent our military intervention. And finally, after the U.S. airlift and sea lift had turned that war around and the Israelis broke through and surrounded the Egyptian Third Army, the Soviet Union delivered an ultimatum to us, an ultimatum every bit as brutal as the one that I helped draft to them 11 years earlier in the Cuban Missile Crisis when we had superiority, an ultimatum which made it quite clear that unless the United States ordered Israel to release the Egyptian Third Army, the Soviet Union would go in and do the job, whether or not we tried to intervene. And the unanimous view of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense at that time was that we had no recourse other than to do what we did, two things simultaneously, to go on our own strategic nuclear alert 3 weeks after the Soviets to fuzz it up, and simultaneously to inform them that we had carried out their ultimatum. So I consider that it was a planned Soviet objective that led at the moment of that crisis to give them the opportunity to exploit in a way that created a huge economic benefit for the Soviet Union that could well have been prevented had we maintained an adequate defense insurance policy and for a fraction of the total cost.
Next question.
Major Boyer, U.S. Air Force, sir. With regards to arms limitation talks, in view of our vast experience with the Russians, what is it that compels our statesmen to continue and to continually give the Russians an advantage with our contracts and to continue to castrate ourselves?
I believe it can only be described as that phenomenon that I referred to in my principal remarks of the naivete with which each administration enters office. Our process generates people who are very skillful in the political environment domestically, but tend not to be well experienced in the foreign affairs and defense field. Many Americans, including most of those who have come to high office, tend to view the Russians as mirror images of ourselves. They tend to credit the Russians with having better motives than they have. The Russian people, I'm sure, have. The Russian leaders are ruthless products, successful products, of a tyranny, men who have learned how to survive in the most desperate kind of power struggles, and who have nothing but ruthlessness and cunning to bring to their jobs. And we do not tend to credit them with that. Nor do we tend to understand that they really mean what they say. It's as clear in their speeches and in their writings as Hitler's Mein Kampf was clear, had we read it and paid attention to it. They say they intend to have political and economic and military hegemony over the globe. They say that the correlation of forces, and they use those words as words of art, have shifted to the advantage of the Soviet Union, and that the correlation of forces they define as involving political, economic, technological, psychological advantages. They don't have all of those, but their military advantages make them look like they have those kinds of advantages. And they assert that that has meant that the West now must continue to accommodate to Soviet policy. They pronounced their Middle East victory as an immense strategic victory. They bragged about the fact that the underdeveloped world was getting $10 billion a year of aid from the free world, and that the Yom Kippur War forced the underdeveloped world to begin to spend $10 billion a year more for oil. They bragged about the fact that that would begin the radicalization of those 30 nations, and they cited what Madam Gandhi did in India, fortuitously undone, as the first example of the radicalization of the underdeveloped world under the success of their economic policies. All of it seems so crystal clear when one has read and studied, yet men coming to office from a basically domestic struggle seem to have to go through a honeymoon period of naivete before they grapple with it. Now, Mr. Nixon, in his first term in office, had, in my judgment, a realistic understanding of what the Russians were about as a result of his long experience in high office as vice president and as a member of Congress. Privately, he used to say to us that he understood that we were militarily behind and that in his second term he was going to level with the American people. When the Sixth Fleet was visited by the president after the Jordan crisis, I ran through for him our calculations as to how the war would have fared in the Mediterranean for a series of about 16 different assumptions, 16 different variations in assumptions. And the results were all pessimistic or guarded, with one or two exceptions where the assumptions were very skewed in our favor. After I finished, Mr. Nixon took me to one side and said, "I understand what you're saying." This was the second or third time I had made the point to him. He said, "You've got to understand my problem. First, I've got to get us out of the war in Southeast Asia. Second, I've got to get the best salt deal I can get. Third, I've got to get reelected, and then I'll level with the American people." I believe he intended to do so, but Watergate hit him in his second term. In December of 1973, at a National Security Council meeting, where I attended as the acting chairman, I listened to Henry Kissinger brief us on the fact that the Russians were going to insist on strategic nuclear superiority in SALT II, and that there was no way that we could avoid giving it to them. Mr. Nixon said, "I understand that, we all understand that, but we must not tell the American people that." Presidents conclude, and I do not consider Mr. Nixon a traitor. I believe he's a crook, but I don't believe he's a traitor. He sincerely believed, and I agreed with him at the time, that he was a better alternative for this country than McGovern. And he believed that the way you defeated McGovern was to be slightly to the right of McGovern on military, and that left all kinds of room. And Mr. Ford and Mr. Carter have had the same view. I am better than the alternative. I am better for the country than the alternative. Therefore, I will do politically what it takes to get elected, and if that means not being accurate about what the military facts are, that seems to fold itself in as part of the political process.
Next question.
Sir, Major O'Sullivan, United States Army. In light of the War Powers Act of 1973, what military options does the President have in dealing with wars of national liberation?
I don't think that the President has many options with regard to wars of national liberation, and I believe that the process that is going to take place in the years immediately ahead is increasing disenchantment by the Congress with U.S. policy and U.S. inability to stand up to the Soviets, and therefore more and more attention to defense, and then finally some improvement in the war powers situation of the President. Even so, even if we didn't have the War Powers Act right now, I believe that to go in and try to undo a war of liberation at the scene is a very chancy proposition. I believe that what one has to have is the strategic nuclear umbrella to make it impossible for the Soviets to consider resorting to nuclear weapons, and to have sufficient conventional military capability that we can deter Soviet forces, or if we have to deal with Soviet forces in third nations. And then under that umbrella, just as the Soviet Union is using Cuba as their Hessian troops, for us to use a combination of covert and overt activity short of the use of U.S. troops. I believe that Korea demonstrated to us long before Vietnam that the half-life of public support in a democracy for a long, drawn-out, undecisive war is very brief. And Mr. Eisenhower came to office just in time to liquidate that thing before we might have found ourselves forced out of Korea by the same kind of problem that we had to deal with in South Vietnam in spades. The 8 years of the war in South Vietnam, by the time Mr. Nixon came to office, left him no real alternative other than to gamble that the South Vietnamese forces could be given a capability fast enough for him to meet the popular demand to remove troops. And I believe, as I said earlier, that gamble would have paid off and could have resulted in a two-Vietnam solution had Mr. Nixon not disemboweled himself.
Next question.
Lieutenant Commander DeNorma, United States Navy. Admiral, with regard to the signing of the SALT I agreement and the next SALT treaty, if the administration does not take the advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with regard to the quality of the SALT agreement, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff feel so strongly against this kind of an agreement as to our inferiority resulting from this agreement, wouldn't it be, should not the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Chairman or the Secretary of Defense, consider resignation and then public protest to get his views across to the American people as you say that we need to do?
I believe that it is the responsibility of every citizen in high office to set for himself a line of conduct that will not permit him to go along with things that he believes are of gross disadvantage to the country. The problem that the average person in office faces is that you have to continue to remind yourself in any position that you are subordinate to and operating within a system that, insofar as the military is concerned, is consciously set up to provide for military obedience to civilian authority. And it is a very difficult proposition when the President of the United States calls the Joint Chiefs of Staff in and says to them, look, as your Commander-in-Chief, I not only have to worry about the military side of it, but I have to worry about what it is possible to do politically. I give you my solemn assurance that this is the very best we can do given the political climate in the United States today. I further give you my solemn assurance that we are going to pursue the following insurance programs. At the time of the Test Ban Treaty, there were a whole series of things that the Joint Chiefs demanded as their price for going along, and President Kennedy agreed to them. At the time of the SALT I deal, there were a whole series of things that the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs of Staff demanded as their price for going along, such as a maintenance of adequate surveillance and intelligence to keep up with what the Russians were doing, such as adequate research and development to be sure that we were ready for any kind of a Russian breakout, such as adequate support of strategic programs so that we would use those 5 years to round out where we were weak. And when you get that kind of a package, it's very difficult then for an individual service chief or a Secretary of Defense to play God or take the President's role and say, I disagree with you because I don't believe that that package will ever come to pass. The package as it is put together is supportable. What then happens is that only part of the deal goes through. The SALT I deal went through, but many of the assurances did not get through the Congress. It is very difficult to know where to take the stand. Now, at the time of SALT I, most of us fell in and supported it along with that package of assurances. By the time we got into SALT II, Paul Nitze, the Defense Department's representative on the SALT team, resigned and wrote one of the most beautiful letters I've ever read to the President, describing that he didn't think it was possible to maintain proper strategic negotiations until there had been restored within the government a respect for the Constitution of the United States. And in this same period, with Mr. Nixon getting mired down deeper and deeper, we entered that period where Henry Kissinger literally seized power and had ordered Secretary Schlesinger not to provide any written advice from himself or the Joint Chiefs of Staff on SALT II. So that one JCS position after another had piled up on Secretary Schlesinger's desk. This then reached a point where I got close to the point that you have just queried about. I concluded that I couldn't live with that directive any longer without knowing that the President had at least been forced to listen to my advice. He was about ready to go off to Moscow to the June-July 1974 summit. So I wrote a letter to the President of the United States via the Secretary of Defense, citing the article of the law that called me the naval advisor to the president. And then knowing that the Secretary of Defense was under orders not to deliver it, I used the same prerogative that every seaman second class has of sending an advance copy to the president. The president, therefore, was in the position of having to admit that he had it. And this led to a series of incidents in which first I was ordered fired, second ordered court-martialed, third ordered not to get any medals on retirement, and finally none of those came to pass. But I was prepared at that point to resign if I had to, or to be fired on the issue. To his credit, Mr. Nixon did not sign that disastrous SALT II that Kissinger was urging him to sign in June and July, although he badly needed it, he thought, to restore popular confidence in him. And as a result, the Vladivostok agreement was less worse than the one that Mr. Nixon declined to sign, and the country is better off today.
Next question, please.
Major Hufstadler, United States Army. Sir, the scope of your talk dealt with a bipolar world. Would your conclusions differ to any degree when you consider Sino-Soviet relations?
The question of Sino-Soviet relations is terribly important. It's one that I would have liked to have addressed in my principal remarks, but there just wasn't time. I believe that one has to view the Chinese, and has had to view them for a number of years, as de jure members of the communist bloc, but de facto allies of the United States. I was in China last July on that same trip where I visited Iran. I had the opportunity to speak to the fellow who was then the senior vice premier, Li Xianyan. Deng came back the day we left. I talked to the foreign minister, Huang Hua, and to a general, Li Da, who was about the number three man in their Ministry of Defense. And their views on Soviet strategy were identical to mine. Their views on the way the Soviets were using detente as a weapon against us were identical to mine. And they were exhorting me and the whole Committee on the Present Danger to work harder to buck up the American people to withstand the Russians. The only area of disagreement between us was that they were confident that the Soviet target after Europe was the United States. And I was confident that the Soviet target after Europe was China. And we both agreed that it didn't make too much difference if we could help Europe survive. The Chinese, in my judgment, have been increasingly concerned about our will. The signs of it were their release of the Soviet helicopter crew a couple of years ago. After they had held it prisoner for a couple of years, they suddenly decided that it hadn't been an espionage ship after all and released it with honor. They invited Mr. Nixon to visit China, a discredited president during the midst of Mr. Ford's re-election campaign, to embarrass Mr. Ford. They've been trying to signal us that they didn't have confidence in us. They made that quite clear to me when I was there. They said, your leadership has been Chamberlain-like. They referred to Mr. Ford as an appeaser. They referred to Mr. Carter as one who hadn't had the guts to even back up the Moroccan and French intervention in Zaire at the time of the first invasion of Zaire. And what they have been trying to say to us through their open actions and through their private discussions is, we have to see both military strength and will in the United States in order to be able to count on it. And if we can't, we're going to have to do the same thing that the Russians did with the British and French in 1939, to cease to count on them and to make the von Ribbentrop Pact, which led to World War II. They're going to have to get the best deal from Moscow they can if they can't count on our will and strength. And I think one of the major immediate challenges to Mr. Carter is to begin to show that combination of will and strength that will let the Chinese continue to tilt in our direction.
Next question, please.
Sir, Major Brown, United States Army. I'd like to follow up the question on will and ask you what you feel is the impact of world opinion on the way that the United States develops its foreign policy versus that of the Soviet Union?
Well, I think that the United States has always been criticized by its allies. That's part of the democratic process. much more than the Soviet Union is criticized by its client states, although there is criticism within the client states, it has to be much more covert and delicately said. I believe that the criticism that we had in earlier years was that, in general, our allies considered us too bold. And I believe that under Mr. Carter, the criticism comes from the opposite direction, that they consider us too timid. And I believe that there is a very great concern on the part of European leaders, many of them with whom I have spoken have said so, that this president just hasn't put it all together yet, that he seems to be operating on a kind of a mystical Christian idealistic view that if we lead the Russians in disarming ourselves, they will match us out of competitive fury, rather than to just to realize that you've got to deal with them as they are, hard-headed realists who are only deterred when they see a combination of power and will. I don't think that the European leaders have given up on Mr. Carter. I think they're just hoping that he will soon see the light.
Next question, please.
Sir, Major Rothrock, U.S. Air Force. Short of a nuclear war or general war scenario, how do you see the Soviets in the future using their ability to interdict Western lines of communication?
Well, as I say, I believe that primary Soviet strategy is to use their military superiority, both strategic and conventional, to take advantage of us around the globe, as they have been doing since the time of the Yom Kippur War. You know, you can just recite the pattern. Cambodia, South Vietnam, Angola, Zaire, Ethiopia, Kenya, the two Yemens, Afghanistan, and so on. To get to your question, if there is a miscalculation, if the United States is backed into a corner and decides that it is not going to back down any further and takes on the Soviets in some way, I believe that the Soviet strategy will be first to try to demonstrate that they can whip us conventionally. And I believe that there is a very real probability that the Soviet Union will try to do that first at sea. I believe the Soviet analyses must be telling them, plus or minus 10%, what our analyses have been telling us for years, namely that we would lose and they would win, the odds are, and that they visualize that winning a war at sea is something that happens in real time, slowly, and that gives the West time to negotiate, and that they would prefer that to overrunning Europe, something that has to happen very rapidly with country after country clamoring for the nuclear weapons to be used, and therefore much more likely to lead to the strategic nuclear exchange that they would prefer to avoid, even though they'll only lose one-tenth of what we lose. Although certainly no one can predict, if I were the Soviet Minister of Defense, my first plan would be to try to win it at sea, give the West time to negotiate its defeat, and then if I were overruled on that, I would advocate going all out both at sea and in Europe, and then giving that time to work before strategic nuclear weapons were used, and making it quite clear to the West that we were going to stop when we got a deal. We'd let them keep half of the Iberian Peninsula and Scotland, and go from there.
Next question, please.
Sir, Major Ritchie, United States Air Force. In your principal address, you referred to President Kennedy involving us in Vietnam because we had an excess of military power. You skipped President Johnson. Do you care to comment on his reasons for getting us significantly increase our involvement in Vietnam and also his conduct of the war during the first 3 years?
Yes, it's a good point because it could well be the case that Mr. Kennedy might have made just the opposite decision. That is, he was, I think, much more capable of reading amongst all of the conflicting signals, the signals from the noise, and may well have decided to liquidate his losses there before the major escalation, because it was fairly early beginning to be clear that you couldn't unscramble an egg, that if you weren't going to go in and really hammer Hanoi and the other cities in North Vietnam, there was no way you could deal with this thing at the fingertips in the jungles. Mr. Johnson had that that massive approach of the great Texan who believed that you could do everything if you put in enough power. I think he visualized that he ran his first re-election campaign against Goldwater. Goldwater would get us into war, I'll keep you out. And then I think he visualized that he could put 500,000 men in there and get that thing over so very fast that he could have the thing liquidated and have people coming back home and have the euphoria of a great victory in time for his next presidential race. I think he also believed that it was the right thing for America to do that. He was dead wrong, of course, with regard to the liquidation and ended up making the sensible decision that he should not run again because he was in such deep trouble as a result of that decision. I do not believe that it was ever possible to turn that war around once we eliminated from ourselves the option of going after the North in a way that would do to the North what strategic bombing did to Europe in World War II.
There'll be two more questions. Next question, please.
Sir, Major General, Air Force. The Soviet Union has a war production economy, in effect. We have a consumer economy. Should we have the will and the direction to catch up, both conventionally and nuclearly? How do we go about that?
That's another very good question, in my judgment, because we frequently tend to understress, and I would like to have made more of a point of it in my principal comments, the extent to which the Soviet Union has achieved strategic industrial capacity. That is, the Soviet Union is cranking out about 12 submarines a year as opposed to our two or three, but they are capable of going to 36 a year with the facilities that they now have in place. They have the same kind of extra capacity with regard to tanks and aircraft and so forth. I don't think many people recall often enough that at the end of the Yom Kippur War, while we had stripped naval aircraft of electronics equipment that was needed over Vietnam and missiles from our 6th Fleet and tanks from the U.S. Army in Europe, the Soviet Union had merely dipped into its warehouses to provide the stock for its clients. So the Soviet Union has both stockpiled equipment to a double order of magnitude greater than we have and has stockpiled industrial capacity. Now, in World War II, when technology was much simpler than it is today, it was possible suddenly to stop the production of radios and commercial refrigerators and so on and to throw it all into aircraft and tanks and ships and to move within a very dramatically short period of time to just skew that industrial capacity to full-time war production. In my judgment, it would take much, much longer in the next World War to do that. I believe that it would take 5 years before one could get, for example, in the case of submarines, from 3 a year to 6 a year. And I believe that it would be more like 8 years before we were beginning to match the Soviet production rate. And the question is, do you have that much time?
This will be the last question, your question.
Major Grazer, sir, Air Force. What accommodations do you see politically and militarily in the next 5 to 10 years towards that we will have to make, as well as our NATO allies, toward Italy due to the increasing influence, it would seem, that the communists have in their government?
It's a very tough question. I wish I knew the answer. The thing that is happening is that the penetration of the communists in Italy is all pervasive and being done extremely skillfully. I talked recently to two Italian youngsters who were daughters of an Italian doctor practicing in Sicily. This fellow makes a fine income and does very well for himself. And those daughters were absolutely communist in their ideology. They believed in the Communist Party of Italy. They believed it was different than the Soviet totalitarian Communist Party. They believed that it was the only answer for Italy. And it was clear that they had gotten that from every school teacher that they had been exposed to as they went along in their school system. You are not going to turn that kind of a thing around with foreign policy initiatives. Certainly it took a great setback with the Moro kidnapping and assassination. That rubbed off on the Italian Communist Party, fortunately, perhaps unfairly. The the real issue is whether or not the Italian system can deal with this very pervasive approach on the part of a very skilled Communist Party. And in my own mind, there is no second issue. In the minds of many others, there is a second issue, and that is, would they behave like the Democratic Party once they came to power? In my mind, there is no doubt that they have disguised their true nature, although others would dispute that. I believe that if the Communist Party comes to power in Italy, it will move cautiously and will pay lip service initially to the democratic system as it uses its position in power first to totally communize the Interior Ministry and the Defense Ministry, and that over a period of years you will see this pattern taking place of gradual leveraging away from NATO until they feel bold enough to make the final break. But I don't think there's any doubt of what it will come if they come to power. I think there is some chance to avoid it, but it's going to take more from within than anything we can do from without to change it. I would like to conclude my remarks by just making a one-minute commentary, and that is, although the general thrust of my evaluation today has been negative with regard to the military balance, I hope that I will not leave you with an excessive sense of pessimism, because I myself do not feel pessimistic about the United States of America. In the ensuing years since I left office, have had a chance through one political campaign and through subsequent opportunities to be all around the country to learn what I referred to about the basic thought pattern and strength of the American system. We all lived through the violence of the Watergate period and saw a country that had a constitutional process strong enough to deal with this one-time freak incident and to come through with the strength. I believe that we are seeing the will of the people, however imperfectly, begin to impress itself on Congress and on the President with regard to a desire to be more thrifty domestically and more conservative with regard to our military capability. And I am very confident that our process will continue and that we can put it all together. And I certainly believe that those of you here from allied countries, as well as those of you here from the American military system, should look on the challenge to you as being the challenge of making do with what you have and using your imagination to visualize the dramatic changes that can come to pass in a very brief period of time as the political pattern changes. Just think how the military must have felt at the time that Chamberlain was selling out Europe, and that Baldwin was admitting to himself, but not to the British people, that Hitler was gaining superiority, and how little it must have been possible for them to comprehend the vast change in power that would take place in a very few years as democracies rallied. I think you constantly need, while working your systems and getting the most out of them and out of your people, to be running through in your mind that congeries of the opportunities that are going to come your way when the domestic political factors change and when you are called on to be the person that stands at your country's side at a time of great national trial and destiny. Thank you. Thank you very much.